A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Corin. We're continuing our conversations today about the fascinating world of global commerce and how it all works when people bring things in from the Far East and China being the world's factory. We've met a few people over the years, Hannah and I, who have periodically gone to China on what they call purchasing trips. These are basically, you know, we talked about buying on AliExpress and this gigantic Alibaba, this gigantic global marketplace where you've got all these factory owners who are vying for your business. But this is doing it for real. You actually get on a plane, you hop out there, and you try to meet someone who is legit. Now, there's a few things that I think people are looking for, and I want to focus especially on the world of interior designs and architecture, given that that's what my wife, Hannah, does. And it's a good example because it's a concrete good that, you know, if you're looking at hitching your business reputation upon something, you don't want to just exchange WhatsApp messages. You want to get out there and see the factory. There's a few questions that I have about this. Number one, there's this kind of middleman who plays an integral role in introducing potential buyers to potential suppliers. And I guess you have to find the middleman before the middleman helps you find the vendors. What is that person typically called? How do you find them? What is their commission or remuneration structure typically look like? Is it borne by the buyer, or is this something that the seller does? And I guess, you know, anyone who's looking to source things from China probably keeps one eye on ethical conditions and, you know, not wanting to buy from factories where unethical labor practices are done. And I guess, you know, I'm presuming there's a whole list of introductory partners who turn a blind eye and show you what they know you want to see. So if you wanted to do this thoroughly, do your own due diligence and find someone trustworthy, if it's your first time considering doing business from China, you've never been to China, but we've never been to China, although I'd love to go join Hannah on this trip. What would you say are some good things to know for the uninitiated before you actually begin doing this and going on your first sourcing trip and hopefully finding a reputable, trustworthy, and long-term business partner in China that'll complement your business, speak your values, and deliver a consistent product that your customers will enjoy?
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He's asking about the actual mechanics of going to China on a purchasing trip, specifically for interior design and architecture goods. The kind of thing Hannah might do. And his core question is, how do you actually find someone trustworthy on the ground? Not just clicking around on Alibaba, but getting on a plane, shaking hands, walking the factory floor. There's a few layers here. Who's the middleman? What do they cost? How do you find them? And how do you make sure you're not being shown the Potemkin Village version of a factory, while the real one is a sweatshop 3 blocks over? You're not buying generic widgets. You're hitching your reputation to physical objects your clients will touch every day. Who's the middleman? How do you find them? And who pays them? How do you do ethical due diligence without getting the Potemkin Village tour? And what should a first-timer know before stepping off the plane?
The middleman question is the right place to start because that person is the linchpin of the entire operation. They're typically called a sourcing agent. They're not, and confusing them is one of the most expensive mistakes a first-timer can make. A trading company buys products from factories, marks them up, and sells them to you as their own. They handle logistics, quality control, paperwork. A sourcing agent, by contrast, works for you. They find the factory, negotiate on your behalf, inspect the goods, arrange shipping, but the transaction is still between you and the factory. The agent takes a fee for their service, not a markup on the product. That's the crucial structural difference.
The trading company is a reseller wearing a helpful hat. The sourcing agent is your boots on the ground.
And for someone like Hannah, who's looking at architectural finishes, custom furniture, lighting fixtures, things where the spec matters down to the millimeter, a sourcing agent is almost certainly the right call. You want someone who represents your interests, not someone who's incentivized to push whatever product gives them the highest margin. You see someone translating for a buyer, negotiating quantities, checking seam finishes, and you approach them afterward. Or you get a referral from someone in your industry who's already importing. Now, on the fee structure. What I've seen from the research is that sourcing agents typically charge between 3 and 10% of the total order value.
Let me pin down the money side, because I think most people assume the factory pays the commission, like a finder's fee. But that setup creates an obvious incentive problem. If the factory's cutting the check, the agent works for the factory, not for you.
This is where the structure really matters. There are two common models. The buyer pays. That's the whole point. The agent works for you, you pay them directly, and that keeps their loyalty clear. If the factory were paying the commission, you'd have a trading company dynamic all over again. Some agents do operate on a hybrid model where they charge the buyer a reduced fee and also collect a commission from the factory, but that should be disclosed, and honestly, I'd be skeptical of it. You might pay a daily rate of $200 to $300 plus expenses, and the agent's loyalty is unambiguous because the factory never touches their compensation.
The third model is the one where you think you're getting a free agent because the factory pays the commission, and 6 months later you're wondering why your walnut veneer is actually printed laminate.
The big names are companies like SGS, Bureau Veritas, Intertech. They'll go into a factory and audit for labor practices, working hours, health and safety, child labor, forced labor, all of it. And there are standards, the most recognized probably being SA 8000, which is a social accountability certification, or the Amfori BSCI, which is a European initiative that a lot of global brands use. Pay for loyalty.
The agent's job isn't just introductions. I want to map out what you're actually buying for that 5%.
It's sometimes called factory shopping, where an unscrupulous agent takes you to a clean, well-lit facility that isn't actually where your goods will be produced. Or they show you audit documents that are expired, or from a different factory under the same ownership group. The term of art is a show factory. 2. Negotiation, not just price, but payment terms, production timelines, quality standards written into the contract. 3. Factory audits. They physically visit before you ever get on a plane. 4. Sample development and review. It's a real problem, and the only real defense is due diligence that goes beyond the scheduled tour. Talking to workers directly, ideally through your own translator, not the agent's translator, checking payroll records. Looking at fire exits, bathroom conditions, the things that are harder to stage. There's a whole checklist culture around this.
They're part detective, part translator, part project manager, and part quality inspector, and you're trusting them with your business reputation. You've got your sourcing agent, and then you've got your audit firm, and they don't talk to each other. It's like separation of powers for your supply chain. If your agent is willing to show you a fake compliance certificate, you'll never know until a journalist or a regulator finds out for you.
Especially in architecture and interior design, where clients are often high-end and values-conscious. They walk you through a clean, well-lit assembly area, show you a break room with a ping-pong table, and hand you a folder with a social compliance audit certificate. You can, but you'll get about 1 million results and no way to distinguish the good from the fraudulent. The more reliable paths are industry referrals, trade shows, and professional networks. If Hannah's in the architecture and design world, there are trade organizations, there are colleagues who've done this before. The Canton Fair, which happens twice a year in Guangzhou, is the largest trade fair in China, and it's where a lot of these relationships begin.
The certificate is a starting point, not a conclusion.
A certificate tells you the factory knew an audit was coming and passed it on that day. What you actually want is unannounced audit capability, which is a different tier of commitment. You also want to look at who conducted the audit. It's enormous. Something like 25,000 exhibitors across 3 phases. Phase 2 is usually the one for home goods, furniture, and decor. So that's where someone in Hannah's field would go. But here's what I think is under-discussed.
Which is to say, nothing.
Less than nothing, because it creates false confidence. Here's a practical thing most people don't know. You can ask to see the audit report, not just the certificate. The certificate says pass or fail. Now, there's another category of intermediary that's worth mentioning, which is the sourcing company. This is different from an individual agent. Companies like Kima or Sourcify or even some of the larger inspection firms have sourcing arms.
There are things you can observe yourself that no certificate captures. Dormitories on site. That's a big one, because if workers live in factory-provided housing, you want to see it. What's the price difference between an individual agent and a sourcing company?
An individual agent might charge 3 to 5%. A sourcing company could be 8 to 15%, depending on the complexity. But your buying process and accountability. An individual agent is one person. If they get sick, or take a better offer from another buyer, or simply decide to stop returning your emails, you're stranded. A company has redundancy, standard operating procedures, a reputation to protect. Look at whether workers make eye contact with management when they walk past. Look at whether there's a union representative or worker committee listed anywhere. Look at the fire exits. Are they blocked with inventory? And I think this is one of those things where first-timers often try to save money by going with a solo agent, and sometimes it works great. But when it doesn't, the cost of failure far exceeds the savings.
Let's talk about the trip itself. Daniel mentioned he's never been to China. Anna hasn't either. You get off the plane. What does a well-run sourcing trip actually look like?
A typical trip might be 5 to 10 days, depending on how many factories you're visiting and how geographically spread out they are. The manufacturing hubs for interior design goods are fairly concentrated. Furniture is huge in Foshan, in Guangdong province. Lighting is clustered in Guzhen, which they call the lighting capital of the world. Textiles and upholstery are often in Shaoxing or Nantong. Ceramics and tiles in Foshan as well, and also in Kaozhou, so you can cluster your visits geographically.
Foshan keeps coming up.
Foshan is the epicenter for anything related to home furnishings. It's about an hour from Guangzhou. If Hannah were doing a trip, she'd probably fly into Guangzhou Baiyun International Airport, base herself in Foshan or Guangzhou, and do a circuit. A well-planned itinerary might hit 3 or 4 factories a day, with buffer time for traffic, which in that part of China is non-trivial.
3 or 4 factories a day sounds exhausting. What do you need to know before you get on the plane?
You're inspecting production lines, checking raw material storage, looking at finished goods, reviewing quality control procedures, negotiating terms, and doing it all through a translator, which adds a layer of cognitive load. A good sourcing agent will have a driver, will have scheduled the visits in a logical order, will have pre-briefed you on each factory's strengths and weaknesses before you walk in the door. Something like 60% of the world's ceramic tiles come from Foshan as well. Dongguan is where you go for high-end upholstery and woodwork. Shenzhen has moved upmarket into design and electronics, integrated furniture. A good agent will tell you, this factory is excellent at solid wood, but their upholstery is mediocre, or this one has great pricing, but they've been late on their last 3 shipments, or this one is family-owned, third generation, incredibly reliable, but they don't negotiate much on price. That kind of intelligence is what you're actually paying for.
The agent's value isn't just translation and logistics. It's institutional knowledge. It's knowing which factory's owner has a gambling problem and might sell your deposit to cover debts.
That's not even a hypothetical. That's a thing that happens. And no amount of Google searching will tell you that. It only comes from being in the ecosystem. If you're planning a first trip, you align it with a relevant fair. The fair lets you see dozens of suppliers in a compressed time frame, compare quality side by side, and identify which factories are worth visiting in person. There's a practical checklist that experienced buyers use. First, worker age. You look at faces. If you see anyone who looks underage, that's an immediate red flag, and honestly, you should probably just leave. Second, working hours.
You use the fair as a filter. Walk the floor, collect samples, take photos, note prices, and then spend the following days visiting the 3 or 4 that seem legitimate.
If you see people working 80-hour weeks routinely, that's a problem both ethically and practically, because exhausted workers make mistakes. A factory that knows you're coming has time to stage the production floor, bring in better equipment temporarily, borrow workers from a neighbor, give them 2 or 3 days' notice at most. There's a business case for ethical sourcing that goes beyond morality. Third, safety equipment. Are workers wearing masks if they're spraying finishes? Are there fire extinguishers that aren't expired? Are the emergency exits actually unlocked? You'd be shocked how often they're padlocked. Fourth, living conditions if it's a dormitory factory, which many are. Are the dorms habitable or are they stacked 6 to a room with no heating? Fifth, wage records.
The raw material storage is an underrated tell. If you're sourcing solid wood furniture and the lumberyard is full of particle board, you've learned something useful.
Another one, check the factory's order book. Not the numbers, they won't show you that, but ask what other brands they produce for. If they're making goods for companies you've heard of, that's a form of third-party validation. A legitimate factory will show you. A factory with something to hide will make excuses. The excuses themselves are informative.
The dog ate my payroll records. And my understanding is that approach doesn't work the way Westerners think it does.
The negotiation culture in Chinese manufacturing is relational, not transactional. The first meeting is not where you close a deal. The first meeting is where you establish that you're serious, that you're not a tire kicker, and that you're someone worth doing business with over the long term. This is the meta problem. You're hiring someone to solve an information asymmetry, but you have an information asymmetry about them. There are a few approaches. One is to ask for references from previous clients in your industry and actually call them. Not just email. Get on a video call. Ask specific questions. What went wrong on your orders and how did the agent handle it? Because things always go wrong.
The actual sequence is visit, express genuine interest in their capabilities, ask detailed questions about their process, build rapport, and then negotiate on the second or third interaction.
When you do negotiate, you negotiate on total value, not just unit price. Payment terms, 30% deposit, 70% before shipping is standard, but you can negotiate that split. And a good agent has a remediation process. They have leverage with the factory. They can get the order reworked or get a partial refund. A bad agent disappears or says, well, that's China for you. A factory that won't budge on unit price might give you net 60 payment terms, which is effectively a discount if you understand cash flow.
The unit price fixation. It's the rookie mistake that keeps on giving.
A good agent's incentive is to find you the right factory, even if that means telling you that this particular factory isn't a fit. Also, an agent understands the cultural norms around negotiation in a way that a first-time Western buyer simply doesn't.
Give me an example. Now you're managing a manufacturing relationship across a 12-hour time difference with someone whose primary language is not English.
There's the concept of guangxi, which roughly translates to relationships or connections, but it's deeper than that. It's a system of mutual obligation and trust building. A Western buyer coming in and trying to negotiate like they're buying a used car is going to offend people and get worse pricing, not better. 6 months later, you're explaining to a client why their custom vanity is 3 centimeters narrower than the drawing specified. And that extends to things like gift-giving customs, dinner etiquette, knowing when a yes actually means maybe, and when a maybe means no. There's a whole literature on cross-cultural business negotiation in China, and it's not something you pick up in a week.
Let's talk about payment and contracts. What's the typical structure for a first order? I assume you're not wiring $100,000 to someone you met yesterday.
The standard structure is a 30% deposit before production and the remaining 70% before shipment, typically after a final quality inspection. With a new factory relationship, you might negotiate that down to 20% deposit. The key is that you never pay the full amount before you've confirmed the goods are as specified. And that quality inspection should be done by a third party, not by the factory, and ideally not even by your sourcing agent, to create that separation of powers we talked about.
The inspection company is yet another vendor in this ecosystem, because I think for someone in Hannah's position, an architect or interior designer who's never sourced from China, the cluster map is the single most empowering piece of information. It turns an abstract, overwhelming task into something concrete. You're not sourcing from China. You're sourcing from Foshan for furniture, or Guzhen for lighting, or Xinwei for stainless steel hardware.
For an order worth tens of thousands of dollars, that's a rounding error. But Lacan is mostly domestic market product. The export quality manufacturers are often in the industrial zones outside the city center, and they don't have showrooms on that strip. A sourcing agent who knows Foshan knows the difference. And I should mention, there's a specific standard for how many units you inspect. It's called AQL, Acceptable Quality Level.
The showroom to shipping container gap.
For high-end interior design goods, you might spec AQL 1.0 or even 0.65, which is much tighter. If the factory is reluctant to show you the production floor, there's a reason, and none of the possible reasons are good for you.
What about the money side of the trip itself? The practical logistics. You're flying into Guangzhou or Hong Kong. You need to get around. You don't speak the language. How does the first-timer actually navigate this?
The sourcing agent handles most of it. A good agent will pick you up from the airport, drive you to factories, translate every conversation, and handle restaurant orders and hotel check-ins. But you should still have some basics. They never are. And this connects to another thing I want to flag. If Hannah is designing custom pieces, custom furniture, or custom light fixtures, she needs to be aware that IP protection in China, while it's improved, is still patchy. There are stories of factories producing extra units of a custom design and selling them out the back door, or slightly modifying the design and selling it as their own. Carry cash. Mobile payments are ubiquitous in China through WeChat Pay and Alipay, but as a foreigner without a Chinese bank account, you may not be able to set those up easily. Cash is still accepted, though increasingly grudgingly.
The business card thing. I've heard there's a protocol.
None of these are foolproof, but they raise the cost and complexity for a factory that might otherwise be tempted. It's a small gesture that signals respect, and in a relationship-based business culture, those signals compound.
The card ceremony. I appreciate a culture that still takes business cards seriously.
Another practical thing, don't schedule factory visits back-to-back across different cities without accounting for Chinese traffic. The distance between Dongguan and Foshan looks manageable on a map. It's about 100 kilometers. It's realistic, but it's a process, not an event. One trip is enough to establish initial relationships, to see who you click with, to get a feel for the landscape.
You budget a week for a first trip. 2 days at the trade fair, 3 days of factory visits, buffer time for travel and follow-ups.
They're not going to roll out the red carpet for a small first order. They're evaluating you as much as you're evaluating them. Then you go home, evaluate the samples in your own context. In Hannah's case, showing them to clients, testing finishes, checking how materials age under actual use, and return for a second trip to negotiate terms and finalize specifications. That's actually a filtering mechanism. If a factory is too eager, if they're promising the moon on a first meeting, if they're offering prices significantly below market, those are warning signs.
Container Full of Regret? That's the name of my next album.
Your album would be called Something About Leaves, and it would sell 12 copies.
11 of those to me. But let's get into the samples question, because I think there's a paradox here. You fly to China to see factories so you can evaluate quality in person. But the samples they give you at the fair or the factory visit might not represent what you'll actually receive. How do you close that gap?
This is what pre-production samples are for. There's a sequence. First, you get showroom samples. These are what you see at the fair. They're often the best thing the factory has ever made. Or a lawsuit. So for Hannah's world, the quality control process needs to be more intensive. You're not just doing a pre-shipment inspection. You might do an inline inspection during production, where the inspector visits while goods are still being manufactured and catches issues early.
Then you keep the pre-production sample. You don't let the factory hold on to the only reference standard.
You sign it, photograph it from every angle, and retain it. The factory keeps a duplicate. When production is complete and you do a final random inspection, or your third-party inspector does, every unit is compared to the golden sample. And you build all of this into the contract with the factory. Milestones, inspection points, payment tied to each gate. It's more administrative overhead, but it prevents the nightmare scenario where you pay the balance and then discover the problem.
What about language? You mentioned having your own translator, separate from the agent's translator. How does that work practically?
You can hire an independent translator in whatever city you're visiting. Rates are reasonable, maybe $100 to $200 a day for someone competent. The key is that they work for you, not for the agent, and not for the factory. They're in your ear, giving you unfiltered translation. They can also pick up on side conversations between factory workers or between the factory owner and their staff, things that the agent's translator might conveniently not relay. This is where the relationship with the factory owner or production manager becomes critical, because you need someone who will call you and say, "This detail can't be manufactured the way you drew it. Here's what we can do instead," rather than someone who will try to make it anyway and deliver something that doesn't work.
The engineering feedback loop. That's actually a value add from a good factory, not a failure of communication.
But if you want to do it in a way that doesn't risk your business, you need infrastructure. The export factories are accustomed to working from Western design specifications, dealing with architects and designers who have strong opinions about millimeter tolerances, and pushing back constructively when something isn't manufacturable. And I should mention, there's a whole category of problem that I haven't touched yet, which is logistics and customs. Finding the factory is one thing.
Let me pull on a thread from the prompt that I think is worth naming explicitly. The prompt mentions finding a partner who will speak your values and deliver consistent quality. That word, partner, is doing a lot of work. We've talked about freight forwarding and customs brokerage on the show before, but for this context, what's the one thing a first-timer is most likely to get wrong? It absolutely does not work if you're an architect staking your reputation on custom millwork that has to arrive on time and match the renderings.
You have to add inland freight in China, ocean freight, marine insurance, customs duties, customs brokerage fees, port handling charges, and then inland delivery at your destination. All of that can add 30 to 50% to the factory price. And if you have it budgeted for it, your margins evaporate. It means you pay on time every time because in the China manufacturing ecosystem, payment reliability is one of the primary ways buyers build reputation with suppliers. And a good sourcing agent or freight forwarder can give you an all-in landed cost estimate before you commit, but you have to ask for it. It's not going to be volunteered.
Let's circle back to the ethical dimension, because I think for a lot of people, that's the most anxiety-producing part. You don't want to be the person who accidentally bought from a factory using forced labor.
Chinese factory owners talk to each other. The industry clusters are tight-knit. If you develop a reputation as a reliable, professional buyer who communicates clearly and pays on time, word gets around. There's a tiered approach. At the most basic level, you ask for the factory's social compliance audit report. If they have a recent one from a recognized auditor, that's a good start.
Your reputation as a buyer is a business asset you're building or burning with every interaction. Which means the first trip isn't just about evaluating factories. It's about presenting yourself as the kind of client that good factories want to keep.
For a large order, that's reasonable. For a small trial order, it might be disproportionate. In a relationship-based business culture, the agent is saying to the factory owner, "This buyer is serious. This buyer is professional. This buyer is worth your time." For a small order, you rely more heavily on your agent's reputation and your own observations during the factory visit. You look for the things we talked about, worker age, safety conditions, general atmosphere.
The agent as character reference. That's the piece that doesn't show up in the fee structure.
And you can also check whether the factory has any public certifications, like ISO 9001 for quality management or ISO 1001 for environmental management. These don't directly address labor practices, but they indicate a factory that's engaged with international standards. An agent who's been in the business for 10 or 15 years and works primarily by referral has probably turned away more potential clients than they've accepted.
How do you verify that an agent is actually experienced and not just good at a sales pitch? What about the China-based platforms? Alibaba has a verified supplier program. Does that mean anything?
It means something, but less than people assume. Alibaba's verification is mostly about confirming the factory exists and has the business licenses it claims to have. It's not a labor audit. There have been cases of verified suppliers with serious labor violations, so it's a floor, not a ceiling. It eliminates the pure scammers, but it doesn't tell you much about working conditions.
The bare minimum of legitimacy. They exist and they're not actively committing fraud. That's the bar.
That's the bar. And for a lot of buyers, especially small ones doing low-stakes products, that's enough. For someone putting their professional reputation on the line with custom architectural goods, it's not enough. They were quality managers at furniture factories or production planners at lighting manufacturers. A few things. One, being too aggressive on price right out of the gate. In Chinese business culture, relationship comes before transaction. You spend time building rapport before you talk numbers. 2. Rejecting hospitality. If the factory owner invites you to dinner, you go. Refusing is a significant slight. 3. Not bringing a gift. Something small from your home country, not extravagant, just a gesture. 4. Being impatient. Factory visits take time.
The domain expertise layer. It's not enough to be a good negotiator who speaks Chinese. You need someone who understands the specific manufacturing process for your product category.
For interior design and architecture specifically, that domain expertise includes understanding Western quality expectations. It is not optional. And 5, making promises you can't keep. If you imply that this trial order could turn into huge volumes, and you have no realistic path to those volumes, you'll be found out quickly and your credibility will be damaged. Chinese factory owners have seen every type of buyer. They're very good at reading who's serious and who's a tire kicker.
Don't be the person who says, "This is just the beginning of a beautiful empire," when you're really ordering 12 lamps.
Be honest about your scale. Small but consistent is better than grand but fictional. You don't say solid wood. You specify the species, the moisture content, the allowable knot size, the grain matching requirements for visible surfaces. Regular but not overbearing. Weekly check-ins during production are reasonable. Your sourcing agent should be providing updates, photos of work in progress, flagging any delays. WeChat is the universal communication tool in China.
The poetry of sourcing. Turns out it's mostly about being aggressively specific.
The least poetic activity imaginable, and the most essential. I'd say for a first-timer in Hannah's position, the single most valuable thing you can do before the trip is develop a specification document that leaves nothing to interpretation. It really is. And the other thing that matters during this waiting period is managing your own expectations about timelines. Production delays happen, shipping delays happen, customs delays happen.
We've covered the sourcing agent, who they are, how to find them, how they're paid, and why the payment structure determines whose interests they serve. The factory says 6 weeks. You tell the client 8. And we've covered the first trip playbook. The cluster geography, the trade fair sequence, the factory visit protocol, the golden sample, the specification document, and the relational approach to negotiation. To synthesize this for someone who's never done it before. Step 1. Find a reputable sourcing agent through industry referrals or trade shows. Step 2. Have them plan an itinerary of factory visits clustered in the relevant manufacturing hubs.
The one thing I'd add is about intellectual property. If Hannah is designing custom pieces, original furniture designs, unique lighting concepts, she needs to understand that IP protection in China is real, but it works differently than in the West. You want to register your designs in China before showing them to factories. Chinese patent and design registration is relatively inexpensive and much faster than the US or European equivalents. A design patent can be granted in 6 to 8 months. Without registration, if a factory decides your design is interesting and starts producing it for other buyers, your legal recourse is extremely limited.
Register before you disclose. That's not a China-specific principle, but the enforcement landscape makes it especially important there.
The more precise you are up front, the less room there is for the factory to interpret things in a way that saves them money and costs you quality. And I'd add a step somewhere in the middle, which is to visit the Canton Fair or a similar trade show even if you already have factory leads, just to understand the competitive landscape and pricing benchmarks.
The calibration visit. You need to know what good looks like before you can judge what you're seeing. A factory that sees you as a one-time transaction has an incentive to extract maximum value from your IP before you disappear.
Between flights, hotels, agent fees, translator costs, inspection fees, and the time away from your business, you're probably looking at $5,000 to $10,000 in trip costs alone before you've ordered a single product. That's the entry ticket. You need enough order volume to justify that investment. Every decision either aligns incentives or misaligns them, and the misalignments are what eventually cost you money, time, and reputation.
The two-word summary of everything we just talked about.
I'd say there's one more thing worth mentioning, which is that the first trip is also about calibrating your own expectations. You will see factories that are cleaner and more professional than you expected. You will also see things that trouble you. It always is. You have to decide where your red lines are before you're standing on a factory floor, because it's much harder to think clearly about ethical boundaries when you're face-to-face with a factory owner who's been hospitable and you've already invested time and travel budget.
Pre-commit to your standards. Write them down. If you decide in advance that you won't buy from a factory with dormitory housing you haven't inspected, or with blocked fire exits, or without a valid third-party social compliance audit, then you enforce that rule regardless of how nice the samples look or how competitive the pricing is. The time to negotiate with yourself is before the trip, not during it.
That's really the through line for all three of the prompt's questions. The sourcing agent, the ethical due diligence, the first trip preparation, they all come down to doing the unglamorous groundwork before you ever set foot in a factory. The people who skip that groundwork are the ones with the horror stories. The people who do it tend to build supply chains that become genuine competitive advantages.
Which is probably why Hannah wants to go in person. You can't subcontract judgment.
You can't. And that's actually the optimistic read on all of this. In an era where you can order almost anything from a screen, the fact that serious buyers still get on planes and walk factory floors says something about what quality actually requires. There's no app for trusting a supplier with your reputation.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Martha's Vineyard Sign Language, used by the island's deaf community from the early 1700s until the last native signer died in 1952, survives today only through a 27-minute film made in 1930 by a researcher who visited the island specifically to record it before it vanished.
A 27-minute film, as the sole remaining speaker of an entire language.
That's somehow both heartbreaking and an incredible act of foresight by that researcher.
The open question I'd leave listeners with is this. If you're building something, a business, a product line, a design practice, and your supply chain is the part you've been treating as a back office afterthought, what would change if you treated it as a core competency instead? Because that's really what a sourcing trip represents, the decision to stop outsourcing judgment.
If this episode sparked questions about your own sourcing setup, or if you've got a trade show story that belongs in the Container Full of Regret Hall of Fame, we'd love to hear it. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.